Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
In the spirit of ANU's motto, which is first to know the nature of things, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and waterways, which were never ceded. We pay our respects to their elders past and present and extend our respect to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening today.
I asked the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
I'm here to make a public statement.
Look, I'm going to shirt front, Mr. Putin.
I am a fighter and not a quitter.
I don't think I know.
I want to thank that fellow down under.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
Hello there, Mark Kenny with another episode of Democracy Sausage, which of course comes to you from the Australian National University. I'm with the Australian Studies Institute and the School of Politics and International Relations. And we are recording a slightly later episode this week, as is customary in May when we have the federal budget, because that, occurs on a Tuesday. I have spoken to the Treasurer about possibly moving the budget so that we could stick to our Tuesday Democracy Sausage schedule, but he's considering it. You know, we'll see whether that comes up. But we're doing this on a Wednesday. That gives us the opportunity, of course, to, rather than talk about what might be in the budget, to talk about what actually was in the budget and to get a sense of, you know, what it all means, what it means economically, what it means politically, what it means for people out there in the economy, in the various places in which they find themselves, the circumstances they have, and how it affects them. And to do that, we've got two of the best. Peter Martin is a visiting fellow here at the ANU. He's also the business and economy editor at The Conversation, a former colleague of mine in the Fairfax days, and, of course, a semi-regular on Democracy Sausage. Welcome, Peter.
Good to be here.
And also Professor Miranda Stewart. Now, Professor Miranda Stewart's been with us before as well. She's a world expert on tax and these kinds of things. She's the director of the Tax Studies and the Tax Group at University of Melbourne. And she's also a fellow of the Tax and Transfer Policy Institute at the Crawford School of Public Policy at ANU. And always a pleasure to talk to you, Miranda.
Thanks for having me, Mike.
It's a great pleasure. Now, what we saw yesterday, Peter, was a surplus announced. That, in a sense, I suppose this is kind of a nerdy question in a way, because it's a very political thing, a surplus, as well as being an economic number. And it's a Labor government announcing it after 15 years since the last time a surplus was actually delivered, assuming this one is delivered at the end of this financial year, but we're pretty close to that, so it's...
I think that's next month, Marker. I think we can bake this one in.
We can bake it in, but it is relatively small at $4.2 billion. It's not nothing, but it's in the black, so you could actually make some back in black mugs now and be reasonably confident that you won't be embarrassed by them for the next several years, which has happened to a former government. But what do you make of the surplus itself? And what do you, I suppose this is a question about, what do you make of the decision to have a surplus, given that it could have been spent theoretically on some things, but the government's shown some level of generosity, but some level of restraint as well.
He almost had no choice, because the way the budget has been tracking is it was in surplus in March, doubtless in surplus in April. We hadn't seen those figures. We'll get the May figures soon, and June's next month. So they've had an avalanche of revenue.
This is something of a shock to people who haven't been following this closely, because, you know, everything else that we've been told about the economy recently, which is why interest rates have been going up and so forth, and all the spending that happened during the COVID crisis, the pandemic, was about, you know, spending vast amounts of money, borrowing to keep the economy afloat, keep employers and employees linked together, and, you know, doubling the dole and all those things that happened, which spent money. I think most people who are not sort of closely following this would be surprised, maybe not surprised yesterday, but surprised in recent weeks to find out that there's been this massive revenue surge.
And who do we thank for it? Actually, apart from, thanking Vladimir Putin, because that helped push up the price of all sorts of commodities, including iron ore, which is twice the price that was expected in the October budget. It's Josh Frydenberg and Matthias Cormann too. So what they did during COVID was decide to abandon decided, as they had to spend really big to support the economy. And they said, this will in time come back to us as greater tax revenue because we are going to get hundreds of thousands of people who would have been unemployed paying tax. I mean, they don't all pay tax because some of them are employed in low-income jobs, but a lot of extra taxpayers. Frydenberg, when the sort of COVID economic crisis was over, Frydenberg doubled down in his final budget, partly for political reasons, partly for economic reasons as well, to see, given that we'd broken the back of unemployment, given that we got it below 4%, something which had hardly ever happened, he wanted to see how far we could push it by spending big. Now, we did that, and we're actually getting the dividend of that. So we got $42 billion in 1 year, unexpected revenue, that's in this financial year, and another 42 in the next, unexpected revenue rolling in. The Treasurer basically couldn't stop calling a surplus, but you are right in saying that this was a choice. And I think there's a lot of, if you look at the conversation, you see it on the website at your nearest vendor of news sites. If you look at it, you'll see a cartoon, which by Wes Mountain, a cartoonist. It shows the Treasurer as a showman walking into a show that says surplus. He is putting on a show, but the show is putting on, and it shows a sort of rather embarrassed Morrison and so on being pushed out of the way, and a few hands trying to grab some help, people who are poor. But he's putting on a show, but not the show you might think. The usual show that someone puts on, a Treasurer puts on, Keating, Costello, Swan, Frydenberg. We have returned the budget to surplus. We are good managers and there it will stay. He hasn't done that. He said, I've delivered a surplus. It won't be a surplus next year. Probably won't be the year after. Probably won't for the next 10 on these figures. So what? Now, by doing that, he has, I think, killed the idea that this is an economic virility test, right, that this really matters. It's true, the previous Treasurer killed it as well by justifiably running up huge deficits during COVID.
Well, he wasn't the first one to do that, in fairness.
Well, no, it happened during the global financial crisis as well. But he has killed the idea that this matters. He's killed it politically. From now on, in the same way as you don't hear people talking about, aside from the odd politician, debt and deficit disaster anymore, COVID killed that. We're no longer worried about that. I couldn't even tell you. I mean, I could if I looked up, but as it happens, I think I did look up. Our interest payments on debt are going down, but no one has paid much attention to that this morning, the morning after the budget. He has killed now the idea that the surplus matters. It's as a piece of political theatre, with long-term benefits, as it happens, I think it's stunning.
Interesting. Your response to that, Miranda, or your interpretation of what did you think of the budget?
Look, certainly the surplus, I mean, it's delivered by that low unemployment in particular, those commodity prices and inflation. I mean, only inflation to the extent that it drives higher GST revenue because prices go up, and to the extent that wages are increased in an inflationary era, then of course we get more tax revenue. But really the unemployment number helps a lot because there's just more people in the workforce paying some income tax as well as the commodity prices.
And not drawing unemployment.
and not so well on the expenditure side, reducing transfers out. But I think Peter's right in the sense that kind of every day the revenue forecast is going up. So even if you planned to spend most of it, you know, 2 months ago, but today you wouldn't have spent most of it, there'd be even more because we're in this sort of odd combination of economic factors. I think looking forward, it is kind of interesting. The budget aggregates going forward is predicting that negative underlying cash balance out to 26-27. So as Peter said, a surplus in 22-23, but deficits in each of those following years, although declining as a share of GDP. So there is a strong assumption that growth will absorb some of that. Gross debt will continue to go up, but more slowly. And in fact, as a percentage of GDP is projected to stay basically the same, 36% of GDP, net debt, in fact, a little higher than in the current year. And when you combine that with some of the other economic assumptions in the out years in the budget, inflation will come down, but unemployment will go up. Growth will come down. And so what we see is that we're not going to have this kind of bubble of revenue, if those projections are correct. We're in this little sweet spot in the current year.
It's a very brief sweet spot, Miranda. It's like a surfer catching a wave. What's about to happen? The wave that's about to
sounds
wash
like
over
you were
us.
Reading my column from this morning.
I haven't read it, but great minds think alike, Mark. What's about to happen is that GDP will grow appallingly low on the government's measure, which is a year-on-year measure. It's different to the one most people use, 1.1%. The one most people use lower, probably about 1%, almost not at all. Population is going to grow 1.7%.
Wasn't the Treasurer predicting growth between 1.25% and 1.5%?
Well, it depends. Most people, sensible people, look at growth from one point to another. Mm. The budget figures compare an entire financial year with the entire financial year before it. So you get a different figure. It produces, with population growing faster, a per capita recession. Living standards are about to go backwards. Unemployment is about to rise on the government's forecast from 3.5% to 4.25%, and then to more than that. You know, that's going to take away or require more people to be on benefits. Also, even though you've got that population growth, jobs aren't going to grow. So you've had employment growth of 2.5% in the last year. Next year, it's going to be 1%. I mean, this is a very brief sweet spot, as Miranda calls it. Things are going to get bad from here on, and they're not going to get much better after that for quite a while.
Yeah, and that raises a very interesting sort of political dilemma for the government because, as Miranda made the point, I think you made the point. It might have been before we were recording. I'm not sure, but
we do our best stuff then, Mike.
That's right. You know, we know we've got an election coming up in 2025, and so you know, you look at this in an economic way, but I also look at it in a political way in terms of the cycle. And those predictions are certainly more dire. We see lower growth, as you say, higher unemployment, which is what the Reserve Bank is trying to bring about. I mean, Philip Lowe said recently, if he could get to 4.5% unemployment. And have inflation trending back into that band that the Reserve Bank looks for, he'd regard that as a success story, which is fine because 4.5% unemployment is historically low. We don't normally have it at that level, Miranda. But it's a kind of a mismatch for the government. It's got some great news this year, but it might sort of start to turn away from it as the term matures.
I think there is some policy measures. I'm glad to see you suggest, Peter, that it's good that we're not anymore seeing a surplus as a sign of virility. To be honest, it'd be good to get the testosterone out of this budget balance altogether. And I think there are some measures that the government is taking, paid parental leave, aged care wages, the expanded childcare subsidy, which was previously announced and which probably does need a bit more work, the sole parenting payment payments out, which are actually investments in the future workforce, and to some extent they're investments in not only gender equity but also better employment results. I think one of the problems with unemployment is that it's it's really sector driven, right? And so the new migration that's coming in will go into some sectors where we really need the employment. But also if we enhance the wages in those sectors, we'll have more tax revenues too, right? And we do have jobs available in those sectors, aged care, childcare. We desperately need people in those sectors. So it's more a matter of changing the labour market, I think, while trying to keep the overall unemployment rate as low as possible.
Do you think, though, that there's looking at the circumstances set out in the budget, the predictions for income from, say, commodities are always low because, or at least they're lower than they are now, because they look at iron ore price, for example, at $55 a ton, which is well below what it is at the moment.
It's about 90 every budget. They say this can't last.
Yeah,
well, and one day they'll be right. But what they've actually done is
It has happened before that they've been right. It didn't last, and I think that happened to Wayne Swan.
That mining boom ended. They are adopting a changed methodology, which still results in the iron ore price halving, but it halves more slowly than it would have. So they're being
They're having a bob each way.
They're being slightly more realistic, perhaps, than they were. But it's right, for quite a few budgets, this has been a hollow log, you know, Christmas present.
It worked for Peter Costello for a long time as well. He had sort of rivers of gold coming in.
He had to hide money. I mean, he was getting so much. He invented all sorts all sorts of places to park money. Rang up, you know, organisations and said, "Would you like an extra boost for your budget?" You know.
But where I was going, Miranda, was that is it possible that that deficit for next year doesn't materialise, or doesn't materialise in anything like? I think it's what 13-14 billion for 2023-24 projected. Could it be like this year? We've just seen a projected deficit wiped out. Could that happen again?
Yeah, look, well, I mean, I'm no geopolitical predictor, but we've still got the war in Ukraine, as Peter pointed out. One of the things that always gets mentioned is China. And when you look at the economic outlook projections in the budget, I mean, they're still our biggest market, right? So what happens there is really important in terms of commodity prices. They're relying on an improved outlook. There's the post-COVID kind of improved outlook in China, which means that construction and so on is continuing and the market expands there for our commodities, and that will keep the price up. But I do wonder, there's been a lot of concern in the longer term. So these things can be very volatile, right? It has been volatile in the past.
I think he'd probably take another surplus, but I think his broader point has been made, which is who cares?
Stop you there, because I mean, you started off talking about as Miranda quoted you on as well, taking the virility out of this idea of the surplus and everything else. But we can't. I think it would be mistaken to forget that the Treasurer did bank, what was it, 92% of revenue upgrades from in October.
That set 82% this year.
So between 87% return to the bottom line, paying off debt. That's pretty significant in terms of putting the budget in a position to be in surplus.
Yeah, he's been generous.
It's not without some credit then that should go to the government.
Well, he's getting credit in two ways, because he's been generous in lots of fields in small ways.
Yes. Well, we'll come to that after a break. We'll talk about some of those different things that have been funded and how effective they will be. So let's take a quick break and be back in just a moment.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Okay, welcome back to Democracy Sausage. I'm with Peter Martin and Miranda Stewart. We're talking about the budget 2023-24, which was unveiled yesterday, the surplus budget. A lot of measures in there. Peter, you were just saying before the break that the Treasurer or the government has been generous, but in
homeopathic doses.
Yeah, that's right.
like JobSeeker, you know, and congratulations to them for doing something.
Yeah, because treasurers have consistently not done anything on this.
And what really disappoints me, what the committee of experts, many of them ANU experts, Peter Whiteford, Ben Phillips among them, what the committee of experts recommended is a substantial increase or a commitment to a substantial increase, didn't need to happen all at once.
To 90% of the aged pension.
An extra $128 a week, right? Chalmers delivered an extra $20 a week and slightly more for Australians over 55. So, you know, if you look at the rent assistance, you know, he made a lot of that, the biggest increase in 30 years, that's $16 a week. That's not a lot of coffees, right?
No.
You know, it's a very small portion of a house.
And relatively few rents that have increased would have increased by an increment smaller than that, and they may have increased more than once recently.
Yeah, and they've done a lot of good things in the health area, a lot of good things, but they're costing, you know, boosting bulk billing for low-income patients and children.
That's pretty significant, that measure.
Yeah, but it's a cost of $1.3 billion per year. They've done the right things. The energy package is probably about that much per year as well. They've done the right things.
I think it's $3 billion when you factor in the states as well. So it's $1.5 billion between the Commonwealth and another $1.5 billion for the states.
The right things in small doses. Now, I think that, well, I'm a perennial optimist, Mark, and I'm terribly trusting. I have the hope that the Treasurer realises that he's going to need to do a lot more. Government, you know, spending as a proportion of the economy is now about 26%. It used to be 24, something like that. Back in the 70s, it was 20. It'll probably need to be 28. It'll probably need to increase for your NDIS, your defence, your health, all of these needs. He's talking about the need for more money, and I think he wants to be pressured. I think he wants to start a conversation about a big tax of some kind, a tax change of some kind that will bring in more money. Getting rid of or halving the stage three tax cuts would be one thing, but other things as well. He will need more money. He's starting to indicate that, and we will want him to do more. You know, I mean, the cost of the submarines is, you know, hardly factored in at all. We will need him to do more. And I think that down the track, if we want the government to do the kind of things that we want it to do, we're going to have to pay more money. And I think he's open to that conversation, although probably not action before the election, as you're saying, mate.
Miranda, there are a lot of small things done in this. As Peter says, the government's acted in a range of different areas, a number of transfer payments and so forth, but they are modest changes. In aggregate, it might amount to a bit, but you know, for people on the dole, I think it's, you know, $2.48 a day or something. In other words, not enough to buy even one coffee. And yet they've delivered that surplus we've been talking about. Could they have done more, or is it the fact that structurally the budget's not in surplus?
Yeah, I mean, of course, in a sense, they could have absorbed the surplus with a bit more spending in the current year. But the issue is not really about the current year. The issue is a longer term and structural issue. The I think Peter's right to say that there's spending in the right places. And one of the things that's interesting looking at the budget is the way the focus on basic healthcare, the focus on some of that income support, the focus on, in particular, single parents. I mean, abolishing Parents Next, some of these things were announced before the budget. These are actually the abolition of programs that cost administrative support and are coercive, and the evidence shows do not get people into work and, in fact, make children worse off. So, you know, one of the things I quite like about the budget across all these different social policy areas is that there is some evidence-based change. There has been empirical research done on some of these programs, and they are winding back things that are harmful. But I think that the reality across all these fields is that it's not actually enough money. You know, I think it's about $5 billion on Medicare, and it's focused on GPs and basic medicine. This is all good stuff.
It's $5 billion over 4 or 5 years.
Over 4 or 5 years. It's just not enough, right? The Medicare system has really been creaking at the seams. They haven't gone into changing the allocation of funding for education for high schools. We're still operating on the previous package. Previous amounts. And so, you know, all these public sector areas need more money. I think that we can grow our way out of some of it, but not all of it. So they have left this kind of where can the revenue come from debate for the future. You know, they'll get a bit more from high-end superannuation. They'll get a bit more from gas in the short term, you know, petroleum and gas. But there's not much else there in terms of revenue raising. So perhaps there's a tax reform debate to be had. Perhaps there's a returning to the revisiting those stage three tax cuts, which people like me have been banging on about to the boredom of everybody for what feels like at least a decade now. Yeah, it's not
that's
because
they announced them way back before COVID. Right? They don't take place till next year, and they announced them so long ago.
Well, this was a political wedge, right, that was announced by the coalition government back in, I think, 2018. and it's still working. It's still working because this government wants to define itself in contradistinction to the previous government as a government that sticks to its promises. And it was very explicit about that before the election, having backed the stage three tax cuts because it could not get the then government to separate the tax reform package. So Labor had to either vote against tax cuts for lower income earners, lower and middle income earners, in order to stop the higher income earners getting these tax cuts in 24, 25, or vote for the whole package. And in the end, Labor decided to do that and now feels committed to it. It's a very interesting sort of political dynamic here around this because there is so much good evidence for why if it shouldn't be scrapped, should at least be adjusted. And people like Danielle Wood and probably you, Miranda, I suspect, are arguing that at the very least there could be changes at the top end.
Some sort of adjustment. I mean, they overdo the inflation return at the top. I think that's the main thing.
Yeah, that's the bracket creep thing, right? It actually overcompensates for bracket creep for high income earners.
You think, Miranda, a tax cut of $2,000 for someone on $120,000 is a bit much, do you? Of course it's a bit much. I think you're right, Mark. I think it was a wedge. I think the idea was to do something so objectionable that by the time it arrived, and by the way, the benefits for low and middle earners, they've vanished because they're only temporary, right? Okay, so they've gone. By the time it arrived, it would look so unacceptable that Labor would have to reject it or modify it. My feeling is, and I'd be interested in your view on this, Mark, on the sort of politics, there's no good way out of this. One thing is, yes, you want to keep your promises. The other is, do you want to do something that almost everyone, unless they're, you know, a beneficiary, and there aren't, you know, that many of those at the top end, thinks is repugnant? It's not a case of one being right or the other being right. There are costs to doing both.
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's fascinating to look at this in the political dynamic of the current government because I think Albanese, for example, is probably less inclined to make changes to this package than would be Chalmers, which is funny when you think about it because Chalmers comes from the right of the party and Albanese notionally from the left. But I think he's very wedded to this idea of fidelity in government, fidelity to what it was that you said beforehand.
Oh, well, he's probably also wedded to the idea of being re-elected. I mean, I would be
interested. But that's what I'm getting at. Yeah.
Yeah, I guess so. I'd be interested in your view about whether if there was to be a change, winding back some of that tax cut next year, isn't that just before the next election?
It is.
Oh, it's a year before, to be fair.
A year before. So in terms of the timing, I mean, and Peter's right that the Lomito is being
lower middle income tax offset.
The lower middle income. Thank you. That's right.
The so-called Lamington.
Yeah. A Lamington. So people will not be getting as big a refund as they have done in the past on
just
that.
When they need it.
Perhaps
it was $1,400 or something.
$1,040, I think.
Yeah, people got at the middle of last year. They won't be getting at the middle of this year when they need it.
Yeah, that's right. That's they, by definition, low and middle income earners. So yes, they are going to feel that. And David Crowe made a very good point about that actually midweek before the budget was tabled, where he said that once it was known this surplus was coming in at $4.2 billion. And he said that the coalition opposed Labor getting rid of ending the Lomito, right?
And even though they ended it, but that's another story.
Yeah, that's right. But once they were in opposition, they were seeing this as a sort of a tax increase because a tax offset was being taken off the table, being not extended by the current Labor government. And Crowe's point was that if the coalition backed it, there's your surplus gone straight away, $11 billion, I think.
Longer term, by the way, when I say longer term, I mean in the next year, a decision will have to be made about stage three at a cost of $20 billion per year, the first year. So big is it that normally government revenue, you can see it in the budget papers, document in budget paper one. Normally each year government revenue increases by a lot, you know, what with inflation, what have you, increased by 7% this year. The year after next, it increases by 4%, then by 4%. But in the year beginning the middle of 2024, when the tax cuts come in, government revenue increases by 0.4%. It doesn't increase. That's how big it is. Now,
and why is that not inflationary?
Why is what? Well, it is, of course, to some extent. Although, to be fair to high earners, they tend not to spend.
Yeah, because they've got so much.
Yeah, and they spend it overseas. So maybe it's not as inflationary.
Oh, but they'll be saving.
What a great consolation that is.
But there is an opportunity, and I believe, I feel in my bones that this is what the Treasurer wants. He wants to be pressured.
Yes.
He wants an environment to be created, as it will by people like me, you know, saying, do you really want to give someone $120,000, $2,000 per year? He wants to be pressured. I can see, and I think it'll happen, that by the time the next budget comes, the discussion about this will be so advanced because, you know, it'll be finally happening that a decision to, say, halve the amount of it and make it more generous to people who actually need it will be seen as obvious and fairly non-controversial. I think we often, whenever there's a big change or talk of a big change, we talk about how awful this will be. I mean, you know, the Australian newspaper, bless them, tried to do this with the superannuation change for people with excessively big superannuation accounts. But, you know, it's going to be the end of the world. And yet often when these things happen, they happen quietly and people wonder why it never happened before and what all the fuss was about. I think the politics can be arranged, particularly with a lot of pressure, particularly with a lot of exposure.
So the government needs to be put under a lot of external pressure.
I believe he wants to be pressured. He can't do it all himself. He wants the environment to be such that, I'm sorry, I just can't really go ahead with this.
In all conscience and common sense, yes. Now, look, in the small amount of time we've got left, I wanted to talk about another area where there is sort of ongoing public pressure, I suppose, Miranda, and that is in the sort of corporate tax area, where, you know, there's a fairly widespread suspicion that, you know, a lot of companies don't pay much tax. Some companies don't pay any tax. What did we learn from the budget about the corporate tax?
Oh, the companies, you know, there are some companies that pay a lot of tax, and that's why those commodity receipts are increasing our revenues so
very
much.
Good point.
So you've got to remember that. That's driving the surplus. And Australian companies, to be fair to them, because they like to pay franked dividends to their investors, often pay a lot of tax. Cross-border, that's less the case, because global multinationals don't really have any interest in paying tax in Australia. They'd rather not. And similarly with our companies that go internationally. So, I mean, one thing that's interesting in the back of the budget, as well as various anti-avoidance measures, which don't have any revenue attached because they can't work out what revenue might be gained, is that they're targeted at multinational enterprises, including Australian-owned ones, that are quite large. And the goal is to, Australia has committed to sign up to a multilateral agreement for a global minimum tax on large corporates. So it's just a line item in the budget. That would be an effective minimum tax of 15%, which essentially prevents holding funds, transferring funds to tax havens and so on. So that's the first commitment we've seen on that. That's good to see.
Well, that's potentially pretty significant, isn't it? I mean, it hasn't received a lot of attention. It's because it's hard to quantify, is it?
It's pretty hard to quantify. It's a kind of change in the international structure for how global corporates are treated between countries. And in, you know, those of us who are international tax nerds think it's pretty exciting. I think Australia's been a strong supporter of that BEPS process bilaterally. Like, so
BEPS stands for...
BEPS is base erosion and profit shifting. So it's the tax avoidance process for multinationals. Bipartisan support is what I meant to say.
Yeah, Matthias Cormann in the OECD has been pushing for it.
Now at the OECD. And so this is our first commitment that we will actually make this law reform change. And my guess is it will be bipartisan.
And it's quite a good thing, this, isn't it? Because the tax system catching up with the fact that we live in a global world and that companies operate across national borders, and they've been gaming the system, moving their tax liabilities into those jurisdictions where it's most favourable, where they have to pay the least.
It's us.
Doing all kinds of stuff like, you know, sort of having their divisions lend to each other and then turning losses in domestic markets and
but
so forth.
It's us using our great power that we rarely use. Governments can operate like cartels. There aren't that many of them in developed countries.
They don't get on too well a lot of the time.
Yes, but if each of them say, look, have the deductions, do whatever you want, profit shift, we don't care, but you're paying 15% tax.
Yeah, it's a really good idea.
If everyone does it and they say, what, where do you want to go? Antarctica? If we do that and we've done too little of it, but this is a start. This is really good. Miranda, you were saying earlier that this will catch big Australian companies as well, because Australian companies tend to do business overseas.
We're talking about corporate multinationals that have a global turnover of about a billion or more, and that sounds like a lot of revenue, but in the large corporate space, there would be quite a few Australian corporates that are in that space, as well as internationally. So it will apply to our large corporates, you know, so even the mining companies, if they've got marketing hubs in low tax jurisdictions, for example. I don't know how much revenue, to be honest. It's more of a kind of institutional or structural change that sort of protects the base for the future. And just to finish on tax, that's the thing I think that's missing really from the budget, and maybe there's a tax reform process in future, is protecting the base of the income tax for individuals as well as companies. Proper tax reform to ensure that we're taxing income from capital and labour fairly. We still need to be thinking about that.
You mentioned trusts again. We were talking before, we should never do that. And why did you mention trusts for individuals?
Well, you might remember, well, trusts taxation is still, I would say, the dominant way that privately held investment and business wealth in Australia is has its tax rate minimised. I mean, the top income tax, the top income people in Australia are not actually paying 47%. They're paying a maximum of 30% or 25% because they're using corporate entities and their income splitting through trusts. And you know, this is still unfinished business. Joe Hockey tried to do it. Like, it's a very difficult thing to do. But because of the superannuation change that we're going to see, where we're taxing high balances, we're going to see even more pressure at the top end as high income earners pull their capital out of super and try to get a lower rate through trusts.
Sounds like some very tough decisions that are going to be, or some thorny debates that the government needs to embark on. And as you say, Peter, you know, they're going to have to, they'll be aided by that to some extent if there is a rigorous public debate about it and people making the case for change, not just the government, but people independent of the government making persuasive cases for change. It's just the nature of politics, I suppose.
Yeah, I call this Chalmers 2 Karen Carpenter budgets. We've only just begun. And the really difficult stuff is going to be making more money. And I think is up to it, but I don't think it's something that'll happen in the next budget, or, you know, with the exception of stage 3, they'll have to make a decision about that.
Mm.
But beyond the election.
Which wasn't in this budget, by the way, didn't get a mention.
Yeah, but, well, it'll have to be either be mentioned in the next budget or its absence will be noted very much.
Yes, yes.
But, you know, beyond the election, the priority will have to be working out how much money the government needs. You know, because of the various needs, we all know what they are that are growing, and then how to get it. Now, the problem is, I suppose, Chalmers is a bit scarred by the experience when he worked for Wayne Swan during the Henry tax review, and you know, basically, Prime Minister lost his job over the mining super profits tax. But it's what's going to have to happen, it'll happen soon, but probably not before the election. But I think Chalmers wants it.
Well, my sense is that I agree there's a degree of scarring there, but my sense about him is that he's a very strategic thinker. He's thinking in the long term about the structure of this economy. He understands the sort of politics. I think Albanese has sort of incrementalist proclivities, if I can put it that way, in terms of the way he sees politics. And I think that's the nature of this government. And we see that incrementalism really even in the way the spending that happened in this budget occurred, as you said.
Good things in small doses,
good things, yeah. A lot for a little and a little for a lot was how someone described it this morning. Look, that's all we've got time for on Democracy Sausage this week. Thanks very much, Peter Martin and Miranda Stewart. And we'll look forward to talking to you again at another time. And that's Democracy Sausage for this week. You can contact us at our email, which is democracysausage@anu.edu.au, and we look forward to your thoughts there. That's it, and we'll talk to you again next week. Bye for now.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.